It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A referendum can be a way for voters to directly affect policy, like a Floridian's decision to restore voting rights to citizens convicted of some felonies, or the vote in Nebraska to expand Medicaid coverage in their state. But a lot of the time, referenda aren't actionable. Advisory referenda, like Wisconsin's marijuana ballot initiatives, can serve as a way for politicians to claim that public opinion is on their side. That's in spite of the fact that there are no official criteria for writing these questions in Wisconsin, for example, and as such, the wording often differs from district to district and isn't neutral. We kind of touched on that a little bit ago when we talked about the dark stores loophole referenda, which in some communities were very difficult to read and understand. Do you know, did you know there was a referendum question in your district before you went to vote, or was the first time you heard about it when you saw it on your ballot? Were there any referenda you felt passionately about that really pushed you to get out and vote in the midterms, or did they not factor into your decision to vote? Do you know what the, for example, the dark store loophole referendum was beforehand? Were you unfamiliar with the issue when you went to vote on it? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is David Cannon, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. David, welcome to the morning show.
Morning, John. Good to be with you.
A referenda are probably best known as a way for people to weigh in on policy decisions in a really direct way. But not all referenda fall into this category because a referendum doesn't always dictate what a legislature has to do. Could you explain how that works, please?
Well, that's right. So there are actually six different kinds of referendum in the state of Wisconsin. Four of them are legislative. So we have state referendum that are issued by the state legislature. So an example of that would be the transportation fund that we approved back in 2014 that passed by an 80-20 margin statewide. There have been 41 of those that have been passed in Wisconsin history, so it doesn't happen very often, but that is occasionally something that voters will vote on statewide. Then we have local initiative that are local direct initiatives that anyone can put on a petition if they get the required signatures. Then there's school referendum that are quite common. We had 77 of those approved statewide last week for an additional $1.3 billion of funding for schools. So that's something that voters often vote on for their local schools, and those are put on the referendum by the school boards in most cases. And then you have these advisory opinions that we had on the ballot around the state on Tuesday for marijuana, for the dark stores. And these actually have no impact on legislation directly. They're only served to allow voters to voice their opinion on these issues. And then finally, we have constitutional amendments that have a whole separate process for changing our constitution. And then we have recall votes, like we had with Scott Walker's recall several years ago. So those are the six different kinds we have. All of them are binding, except for the ones that are the advisory referendum.
We had quite a few advisory referenda on the ballot this past week, and we talked about one of those, the Dark Stores loophole referenda, which I think 23 different counties, cities, villages had around the state, and so there were a lot of those. And here's the wording in one. This is from Dane County. The ballot, the referendum question was worded this way: should the state legislature protect residential property taxpayers by preventing commercial and manufacturing property owners from using tax loopholes to shift the tax burden to homeowners? Well, now, Dave, this strikes me as if I was a lawyer, I would object that this is a leading question. Why wouldn't you vote yes when it's worded like that?
Well, right. I think the amazing thing about this referendum is that 8% of the voters still said that they wanted this burden on them as taxpayers. So, right, I totally agree. This is a very biased wording of the question. And on the previous segment, you talked to someone who discussed how difficult it was to get a fair wording of a complex issue like that. And I understand that, but this was still not very well worded. That even using the word loophole itself seems to me, that's a loaded word that tilts in the direction of saying this is a bad thing. So this is not a neutrally phrased referendum. And it's not surprising that 92% of voters said that they wanted that burden lifted from them.
Who actually writes these things?
So the county boards actually are the source of most of these. They can be brought by individual citizens as well, who could petition their board to put something on the ballot. But according to the Wisconsin Election Commission, that had an advisory memo on it this summer because they were receiving so many questions about these advisory referendum, the Wisconsin Election Commission said the county boards aren't bound to put anything on the ballot they don't want to put on the ballot. So it's really up to the county boards. And I believe that there were 23 that had the dark stores, and then there were another 17 that had marijuana on the ballot this last week.
And just for those who may not have heard our earlier discussion, the dark store loophole allows big box stores to assess the property value of open stores based on the value of vacant or closed stores. And that's been a real bone of contention for a lot of municipalities around the state, which is what prompted some of these initiatives. David Cannon is chair of the Political Science Department of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about referenda and kind of going through some of the minutiae of how they get on the ballot and what they actually do. 800-642-1234. Tell us if you actually knew there were referendum questions in your district before you went to the polls, or was the first time you heard about these issues was when you saw them on your ballot? And did, if you knew there was a referendum question, is that what pushed you to go out and vote in the midterms, or was that not a factor at all? And if you saw a referendum question on your ballot, was it worded in a confusing or a leading way? How did you feel about it when you saw it? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Given the fact that the individual county boards can write language however they want into these advisory questions, when these questions pop up around the state, if the wording is different in every locality, how can it really be an accurate assessment of what public opinion is on any given issue?
Well, that's a really good point. And that especially when it concerns state legislation, like the dark store issue would have to be really resolved on the state level. Same thing with marijuana. That would have to be a statewide policy. When you have, 16 different versions or 23 different versions of this, coming up, it really is hard to have any, sort of uniform wording if they're all being written by different county boards. And so it is hard to know what to make of this. Now, on the other hand, I think you can definitely get a general sense that voters in Wisconsin do seem to favor legalizing marijuana, either for recreational or medicinal uses, as some of the counties just had for medical marijuana. And so you get that variation as well in terms of the marijuana legalization. Is it just for medical purposes or recreational use? And so it is harder for state legislators who are trying to use this information to be able to say, yeah, we really know exactly what the voters think.
It would seem to make some sense for example, the Wisconsin Counties Association, which is a statewide group, if they really feel strongly about something, to get together and come up with some wording that would be consistent, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be a real improvement. And then you also could put some more effort into trying to get the best neutral language you could for the wording of the question as well, which would really help voters.
Okay. David Cannon stays with us as our conversation about referenda continues. He's chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. What do you think? Were there referendum questions on your ballot? Were they difficult to understand? Were they confusing? Were you surprised by them? 800-642-1234. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Stay tuned. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Lots of local units of government in Wisconsin had referenda on the ballot last Tuesday. Some of them were about increasing local property taxes to help pay for schools. Local taxpayers approved more than $1 billion in increases for that purpose. There were a number of advisory questions on local ballots, however, about things like legalizing marijuana or closing the so-called dark stores loophole. Did you know there were referenda on your district ballot before you went to vote? Or was the first time you heard about it when you saw it on the ballot? Were there referenda you felt passionately about and they really got you to go out and vote in the midterms? Or did that not factor in your decision to vote at all? Did you know, for example, what the dark store loophole was all about before you went to vote? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings as well. Three ways to get in touch. We want to hear from you. David Cannon is with us. David is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Let's go to the phones. Jody is with us, calling from Janesville. Jody, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had gotten a sample ballot ahead of time so I could look at the referendum, and I really really was encouraged to vote more for the governor's race than the referendum, but getting that sample ballot helped me to understand what the questions were, and I did that ahead of time.
Did you request that, or did it just show up?
My husband had gotten it. His mother does the voting volunteering, so they got to vote early, and they brought me a sample ballot.
Okay. Jody, thanks a lot about that. Another thing, how informed are voters about referenda, David Cannon? How much, for example, particularly on more obscure policy issues like the dark store loophole?
Right. So on issues like this, for the dark store loophole, for the medical marijuana, that are just the advisory referenda, these probably don't have very much voter information. There's not any advertising really concerning these. Their interest groups don't get involved as much because they're not binding. You contrast that to a statewide referendum that really matters, where you're actually implementing law. And then you get millions of dollars spent by different groups on both sides. Say, you know, for example, you talked about the felon reenfranchisement in Florida or expanding Medicaid in three states that were on the ballot last week. In cases like that, where you're really changing law, then you'll have a lot of money spent advertising, educating voters. Voters do go to the polls and pretty informed about those issues. But when you have these advisory referendum, I would say most voters probably didn't even know that they were on the ballot. And Jody's probably the exception for being a super well-informed voter who actually, you know, went to the trouble to get a sample ballot and look at that. You know, most voters weren't in that position, and they went to the polls really not knowing anything about these issues before they voted.
Well, it seems to me, though, that access to sample ballots, if you've got a smartphone, even if you don't have the internet, if you've got any kind of data plan, it's not that hard to find what the sample ballot is for your district, at least not in Wisconsin. You can look it up, but maybe people are busy, they don't bother, or if it's non-binding, people don't really care that much about it. I don't know. What is the point of a non-binding advisory referendum?
Well, the main point for the non-binding advisory referendum is simply to inform the legislators about public opinion. And these are usually put on the ballot by groups that want to influence policy in the direction that they favor. And so the marijuana initiatives obviously were on the ballot because, you know, some people in the state think we should legalize marijuana either for recreational or medical use. And so they're trying to show state legislators that, hey, we've had 60%, 65% of your constituents, you know, favor this policy. So it's a way to try to pressure state legislators to actually enact state legislation on that issue.
Can these advisory referenda drive turnout at the polls? I mean, we've heard from a handful of listeners over the past week who suggest that the marijuana legalization referenda in Wisconsin were a big factor in helping Democrats win because it brought out so many people to vote who wouldn't have otherwise. Do you subscribe to that theory as well?
Well, we don't have any systematic evidence to support that claim. There's nothing in the exit polls asking about that. So it really just be speculation to try to make that link. My sense is that you know, most voters wouldn't be motivated if they knew it was just an advisory referendum and not a binding referendum. So the most well-informed voters will say, you know, yeah, maybe I care about marijuana legalization, but if you know it's just advisory, it's really not, you know, that much of a tangible reason to go vote. So I would find it hard to believe that very many voters were actually motivated to go to the polls by these advisory referendum when in fact they have no direct impact on law.
Can you think of an example of an advisory referendum that actually ended up causing the legislature to do something in one direction or another? Is there research on that?
Well, that's a good question. In looking at the, again, I mentioned that there are 41 different statewide referendums that have been approved in Wisconsin history. So this doesn't happen that often. And the most recent ones that have been approved, like the Transportation Fund, that was approved in 2014 and passed by an 80-20 margin. That, to my knowledge, didn't have any advisory referendum prior to that approval. So in the most recent cases, they didn't have a direct link between an advisory opinion, advisory referendum, and then the actual referendum being passed. But there, it's possible that we have had examples of that. I just can't think of one.
Okay. Do you think in general that the referendum as a means of advancing policy, is this good for democracy?
I think yes. I think the direct referendum can be very good for democracy. And if you look, in fact, what happened around the country last Tuesday, we had a lot of referenda that passed in states where the state legislature had refused to go in that direction. So things like nonpartisan redistricting commissions are extremely popular with voters every time you put that to the polls, but they're not supported by politicians who don't want to give away that power. So that's a perfect example of where direct democracy really can have an impact on improving, you know, the nature of their political process. Also things like expanding Medicaid, increasing the minimum wage. You know, these were passed in red states and Republican states where the state legislature didn't want to have those policies, yet the voters were able to get around that by a direct referendum. So I think that this really can be a very positive thing for democracy, for sure.
We've seen, and you commented on this earlier, that there's been an increase in the number of referenda to support additional school funding at the local level. What does that say about public opinion about, for example, taxes?
Right. I think it's very dramatic that here in the state, we had $1.3 billion approved by voters in 77 different school districts around the state on Tuesday. You know, that shows, I think, that voters, when given the choice, really do want to support education, even when it means increasing their own taxes. And so this is, you know, voters saying, yeah, I'm willing to pay a higher property tax rate to fund better schools. And this is, you know, last week was just the most recent example of we've seen, you know, over the last several years, billions more in school funding through direct votes like this.
And how has the legislature responded to this?
Well, in the last two-year budget, schools finally did get an increase in funding. But as everyone knows, you know, we had pretty huge cuts in public education funding before that. So in part, I think you can see the school referendum as a response to that recent history of deep cuts for public education. And this is the voters' way of saying, hey, those cuts are too deep, that they're going too far, and we want to restore some of that funding for our schools.
Let's take a quick call from Dave in Oconomowoc. Dave, go ahead. We're almost out of time.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to know how it can possibly be legal to have a marijuana vote that it covers the whole state and only have it in areas that are dominated by college students and liberals. How can that possibly be legal?
Okay, Dave, thanks. The marijuana referendum, you want to explain that for Dave?
Yeah, so again, these are just advisory referendum that were only on the ballot in these specific counties. So six counties in the state had it on the ballot for recreational use, 11 counties for medical use. And this is not binding on the entire state in any way. This is just the advisory referendum that are saying the voters in those counties think this would be a good idea. And the state legislature can either pay attention to that or they can completely ignore it, just depending on what their preferences are.
And so it doesn't really, there's no direct public policy impact of any kind. So Do you think that there should be maybe some changes to the way we handle referenda so that it's we can get some more real insight into how the public feels about a given issue by, for example, I don't even know how you would do this, but maybe forcing a more consistent wording on issues?
Yeah, well, as you pointed out earlier in the half hour, the county boards do have a state association, and they could use this as a vehicle, perhaps, for stating some uniform wording of ballot initiatives. And so if you wanted to have a referendum on a given topic, the county board association would recommend, here's our recommended wording on this issue. If you want to put this on your ballot, do so, but here's the wording you should use. I think that would be a great idea because it would give us more meaningful input then from voters and probably better question wording as well.
Okay, having solved the problems of the world, David Cannon, we're out of time. Appreciate your time this morning.
Okay, good to be with you, John.
David Cannon, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Stay with us. More to come. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The headline is that we won the war on smoking, but when you read the whole story, the picture changes. While overall smoking rates have declined dramatically since the 1960s, that mainly applies to middle and upper class Americans. The poor are still smoking and suffering the health consequences in increasing numbers. Do you currently smoke and come from a low-income family? If you've tried to quit but haven't been able to quite get over the finish line, what's the hardest part about quitting for you? Is it stress? Do a lot of other people around you smoke, making it harder to avoid? Tell us your story. Or maybe you previously smoked. How did you quit? Did your friends and family encourage and support you? Were you one of the few people at your job left smoking? And did the culture around your office help you quit? What was the key to quitting for you? Either way, tell us your story at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can join us by email. The address is ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor and director of mental health policy at the Stanford University Department of Psychiatry. Keith, welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning.
At one point, poor Americans were slightly less likely to smoke than middle-class Americans. Tell us about when that was.
That would have been in the 1940s and 1950s. People who had higher education and higher income smoked a little more, probably because it was a habit that they could more easily afford. And it may also be because lower-income people tend to be more religious, and some religious people don't smoke. But as we've moved forward and we've done this terrific thing. You know, we've reduced smoking dramatically. It just hasn't been even. So although low-income people today smoke less than they did, 50 years ago, it's still the case today that almost three-fourths of smokers now live in low-income neighborhoods.
Okay, so once we learned about the health risks associated with smoking, how did people start changing their behaviors?
Well, a huge number of people just quit. They were probably not addicted, and we have to remember, doctors did ads for smoking. Smoking was not thought to be dangerous. So when the initial Surgeon General's report came out, a lot of people who weren't dependent on smoking sort of did it as a habit or socially just stopped. But that's the easiest, fruit to pick off the tree. Then people are left tend to be more dependent, and they had to work at it in lots of different ways. Some people sort of white-knuckled through it. Eventually, we developed things like the Nicorette gum and the patch and the lozenges, which helped more and more people quit. And then the last thing is we had a big social change. I mean, in the environment, we became less tolerant of smoking. We passed laws to make it harder to smoke. We raised taxes on cigarettes. And all those things help push more people out of this deadly habit. That's terrific. But as I said, there's still some people left. Yeah.
Well, the statistics are, high-income families decreased their smoking by 62% from 1965 to 1999. versus only 9% for low-income families. And some of the things you mentioned that might be aids to quitting smoking, like the nicotine gum and so forth, the patch, those all cost money, and people may or may not have some kind of insurance that would help pay for it. Is that part of the problem here?
Yeah, it certainly is. And in fact, it's interesting, just in the election last week, I noticed, you know, Idaho, Nebraska, Utah expanded Medicaid. And that's actually important, very relevant to this thing we're talking about, because if you're on Medicaid, it almost always covers nicotine replacement therapy, maybe some brief counseling. But if you don't have that and you don't have insurance through work, you just have to, you know, try to quit on your own. Some people can do that, but it's way, way harder particularly if you're really addicted, than when you don't have that access to those medications. So that puts poor people who are trying to quit at a disadvantage against people who have insurance.
And in Wisconsin, the government applied for a federal waiver in order to, among other things, have people who smoke pay a premium, basically, for Medicaid in the state. So that would make it even more difficult for those folks to deal with some of the health problems associated with smoking. Is that kind of thing common around the country, or was that something uniquely Wisconsin?
I'm not aware of other states that have done that, and it's one of those things that, independent how one feels about it ethically, I suspect economically, we're actually much better off having smokers have access to Medicaid, because when you stop smoking, you're far less likely to get cancer, have a heart attack, have a stroke, and those conditions are extraordinarily expensive and almost always in some ways fall on the public purse, even if it's just people showing up in emergency rooms. So you're probably better off. That's probably one of those economies that isn't an economy, and it'd be cheaper just to let people have the coverage.
Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor and director of mental health policy at Stanford University's Department of Psychiatry. Let's take a call here. Ian is with us in Milwaukee. Ian, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. So I smoked. I'm a young guy, but I'm 25 now, and I stopped smoking about a year ago. I smoked for 2 years. Couldn't even really tell you why I started, but it's not something I wanted to do, but I just find myself addicted like a lot of people do. And my girlfriend absolutely hated it. She convinced me to get like one of those handheld, like electronic vaporizers where you put the oil in with mm-hmm. the nicotine. And so I tried that, and I was using it a lot. And she definitely preferred it. I definitely preferred it. And then, you know, what you can do with those is you put less and less nicotine in the oil, but I didn't even need to do that. I just found myself smoking that less and less, and now I don't smoke at all. So I know we're talking about income here. I know those things can kind of be an investment. Mine was about $50. But if you do that, I mean, that helped me a lot. I'd recommend people try that.
Ian, thanks for sharing that. Keith, you boil the discrepancy in behaviors down to several reasons. The first is that lower-income smokers take longer and deeper drags on each cigarette than middle- and high-income families. Tell us about that and maybe comment on how Ian changed his behavior.
Well, I would say congratulations to Ian. That is terrific. I'm happy for him and his girlfriend. And you know, the step down seems, you know, that's what a lot of people need because the withdrawal is very intense, particularly the first couple of weeks can just be rotten. So, you know, he did it with a vape product. That's terrific. Other people take that step as well. And, you know, vaping's not good for us, but it's way better for us than a combusted cigarette. So that's certainly terrific. But anyway, you know, people who are lower income, yeah, may on average be more addicted. So, you know, take deeper drags, tend to smoke the cigarette down to the very last, all the way down to the filter, pick up a used cigarette and relight it, that sort of thing. All of which, you know, suggests that they're going to be more dependent on nicotine, and that's the, you know, key reason why it's so tough to quit smoking. So they often need the support, and the kind of support, you know, Ian got through that product to quit.
Let's just momentarily talk about the problem of nicotine addiction, because I know somebody who was a recovering alcoholic and had been a four-pack-a-day smoker for decades who told me that there wasn't a day that went by he didn't crave a drink, but not an hour that went by that he didn't crave a cigarette. How powerful is nicotine addiction?
You know, I've had a similar experience. I've asked a number of people, who've been patients who have quit multiple drugs, what's the hardest one? And it's very common that they say tobacco, even people who quit serious alcohol problems, cocaine problems, and heroin problems. So it is extremely addictive. But the good news is that, you know, the most damage that you get from a cigarette is not the nicotine directly, but it's all the tars and things and carcinogens that you inhale. So if it turns out that somebody can't break the nicotine habit, but they can at least break the smoking tobacco habit, and they end up being on the patch for a long time, their health is way better off than it would be if they kept, you know, lighting up.
Lower-income people also more likely to smoke than their higher-income counterparts, you say, because of who they work with and live around. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Yeah, I mean, when I moved out from the Midwest to California and at the hospital at lunchtime, I remember seeing all these people are wearing gym clothes and stretching, and I'm like, what's going on here? It's like, oh, they all go running here in California. They all exercise at lunch in California. Very soon, I was doing the same thing. And it's a very common experience. I mean, when we want to change health behavior, it's what are the people around us doing? If you want to diet, join a group that they're all working together to diet. Well, ditto if you want to quit smoking. It helps a lot if you're around people who don't smoke who are also trying to quit smoking. Well, for me, that's easy. As a middle-class person, hardly anyone I know smokes. I hardly ever see a cigarette. But there are places, if you work in the washing dishes in a restaurant, you can be in the opposite situation where everyone's smoking. You're offered a cigarette. You smell cigarettes. That makes it really tough to quit. You got all the cues there. You got the social pressure there. And also sometimes smoking is how people relax together. So that makes it just tougher to stop. I mean, smoking is really, it's like a snowball going downhill. As your friends quit, as your neighborhood quits, it gets easier and easier and easier. But when they haven't, it's harder and harder and harder.
Well, the counseling advice given to anybody who's addicted to something is that you have to change your surroundings so that you're not around what it is you're addicted to. So that makes perfect sense from that standpoint. This shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that this is true, I guess, is what I'm saying, right?
No, it is true that if you want to make a change, having people support the change, family, friends, and so on, it makes it easier. But it's hard, it can be hard to switch out. What if your people at work you're really close to, you like, and the way they hang out is they have a smoke break each day. It makes it tough unless you can convince them all, which sometimes happens. Let's all try to quit smoking together. Sometimes that works.
How does access to health care impact the probability that you'll be a smoker?
If you are, most people who are left smoking today are pretty addicted. I mean, all the people who are shaped by information, social pressure, have quit. So you have a pretty hardcore group of people. And having access to, nicotine replacement products of any sort is going to roughly double the odds any quit attempt is going to succeed. So if you don't have that and you're just kind of, white-knuckling it, sometimes people do it. There's no doubt that they do it. But it sure is a lot harder. Very easily get in this habit. I mean, even people who succeed quitting smoking have tried and failed on the average about half a dozen times before. It's a tough habit to break.
We're talking about how our likelihood of smoking is tied to our socioeconomic status. The shorthand for that is the poor smoke more than the rich. Keith Humphreys is with us and stays with us. I'm John Munson. Our conversation continues on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Your socioeconomic status is a strong indicator of whether you'll be a smoker or not. In other words, our sharp decline in tobacco use overall in America comes with an asterisk. If you smoke, have you tried quitting? Do you have access to the kinds of support programs that you need in order to quit? Do you have a family member who's tried to quit smoking? And do you think increasing cigarette taxes is a way to curb tobacco use? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor and director of mental health policy at the Stanford University Department of Psychiatry. Keith, we had an email from John in Madison who wants to know if there's a difference between chewing tobacco and smoking it from a health perspective. Keith, do we have any data on whether there is also a class difference in chewing tobacco like there is in cigarettes?
Yeah, chewing tobacco was always more popular among lower-income and upper-income people in the United States. And you have different risks from the two things. I mean, so if you are you have the tobacco in your mouth, that puts you at higher risk for oral cancers, but you have a lower risk of lung cancer. And for a smoker, that'd be the other way around because you're pulling that, you know, the carcinogens deep into your lungs.
And what role do you think stress plays in one's likelihood to smoke or not?
Well, you know, it is. I mean, the thing about all things to which we get addicted is they feel good in the short term. And one of the ways they feel good is that they can relieve any stress that we're feeling. And virtually everyone who smokes will tell you that. Even if they, say in the end, I know this is bad for me and I hate the way I feel when I get up in the morning, at least at the moment, particularly when things are difficult, I enjoy that cigarette. And broadly speaking, you know, there are exceptions, but broadly speaking, it's, daily stress is a more common thing when you're living on the economic margin than when you feel secure in your, you know, economic situation and your life situation. So you could certainly imagine that that would make it more attractive to start smoking and also harder to quit smoking if you're in a situation where you're economically struggling and under stress day to day.
And do tobacco companies market their products to the poor more than to other groups of people?
Yes, they do. And that is another really important difference between poor and middle-class communities. Anyone can see if they just, you know, walk through an example of each. Far more, you'll see far more advertising, both, outside stores, but inside stores, like, you know, in the little convenience shops, that kind of thing. There'll be ads all over the place. And there's also just more places to buy tobacco in lower-income neighborhoods than there are in middle-class neighborhoods. And that makes it easier to keep going. I mean, if everybody had to drive, 10 miles to get a cigarette, that would make people more likely to quit or less likely to initiate the habit. But when it's everywhere and it's very easy to do, that makes it really easy to continue the habit. And if you're also trying to quit and you're in that struggling phase, particularly where it's quite unpleasant, and then you look around and you see an ad of, attractive person smoking, that raises your desire even more. You go into the store to buy milk and there's, cigarette ads all over the store. Again, that's, can easily trigger you to think, okay, I'm going to break down and buy another pack.
And what about the role of cigarette taxes in helping people reduce their smoking? Have we seen whether or not these are effective? I mean, some of them are quite high. In New York City, for example, with the tax, a pack of cigarette costs more than $10 these days. Do we know that this works, or does this just make life harder for poor people?
Well, it does help enormous numbers of people quit. It also probably helps even more people to avoid picking up the habit in the first place because they don't want to, pay the cost of it. The group that's the most sensitive to price tend to be young people, because they have less disposable income, but also that'd be true of low-income people. The other question you're raising is, gets to be a social justice question. At some point, if taxes get extraordinarily high, are we just punishing low-income smokers? And I think that, that is a legitimate question. I'm more worried about the fact that, in the states with a fair amount of low-income people and in a strong tobacco industry, taxes are still ridiculously low. I mean, there's plenty of places where, taxes are 50 cents a pack, 75 cents a pack, places like Virginia, West Virginia, and they have extremely high rates of smoking. So, bringing those up would probably produce a lot of public health gains.
Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor and director of mental health policy at the Stanford University Department of Psychiatry. We've seen that the opioid crisis is hitting poor communities the hardest. Is there any link between nicotine addiction and other types of addiction?
We're not aware of that, but I think a far more likely link you may see more in the future is marijuana in tobacco. Marijuana use is very similar to tobacco use in terms of the profile. About 80 to 85% by volume is consumed by people who didn't go to college, didn't graduate college. And it's smoked, of course, and some people smoke cannabis and tobacco together. So one possibility as we, you know, are developing the legal industry and we're having a lot of promotion, as you'll see, an alliance between the tobacco and the cannabis industries, maybe to push back on anti-smoking laws or just to sort of make smoking normal again. And that, I think, is the biggest risk of a revival of tobacco via that route of marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call here. Carol joins us from Madison. And Carol, we're starting to get short on time here.
Okay, it'll just be just a second. I just want to quick tell you how tobacco use is so addictive. I've been a smoker for about 45 years, not a super heavy smoker. In 2011, I had a heart attack, and I just still, like, I quit for like 6 months, and then I went back to smoking. And I continued to smoke, and by 2012, in order to, you know, it encouraged me to get on the heart transplant and list, heart transplant list. And in 2012, I quit. By 2014, I had a heart transplant, which I am so happy that I that I had quit and that I have now a new heart and I have something to live for. But I was at the point where I only had a couple months to live.
So it was a life and death situation for you, Carol. Thanks for sharing your story. So Carol's an example of somebody who had to try several times to quit, and it required a life-altering event to finally get her over the top. How common is that?
It's actually quite common, and you know, and a large number of people quit smoking after a heart attack, but still, you know, a bare majority keep on smoking, which I think attests to the incredible addictiveness of the product. And you just got to keep trying. I mean, you know, it can be discouraging, but you got to keep at it. You eat, no matter how long you've been at it. If you can quit smoking, your health's going to be better.
For the non-smokers listening who don't think this affects them, what would you say?
Oh, you know, we're all affected by each other's health, whether we want to be or not, you know, and, you know, I just see this, we're all in this together. You know, when you go in, when you seek the ER and you want care quickly, you're affected by how many other people are having heart attacks or having strokes or had an accident and so on. And a lot of that is driven by things like smoking or drinking or other types of things. So we really are, you know, you're better off in a self-interested way. In addition, I think in a humane way, to want to try to help people quit smoking, even if their economic situation is drastically different than your own.
We got about a minute left here. If we want to see smoking rates decline among the poor, what's our most effective course of action here?
Well, the fact that, as we talked earlier, you know, three states have expanded Medicaid further. A number of other states did so a few years ago under the Affordable Care Act. But there's still a lot of states, and they tend to be low-income states with lots of smokers, that haven't expanded Medicaid. So that'd be a very good investment for states that want to, you know, help people break this habit. And I think they'll be very happy they did, not just in terms of the health, but economically, you know, the burden on the public purse is actually less when people quit smoking versus ending up with lung cancer or having a heart attack or stroke.
And cigarette taxes?
Cigarette taxes are highly effective. You know, those states that have low taxes should really consider raising them up, you know, maybe, but, you know, to the national mean, yeah.
Keith Humphreys, thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor and director of mental health policy at the Stanford University Department of Psychiatry. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.